Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, November 17th, 2021. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Council Rejects Nueva Vista Project, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland City Council unanimously voted down the development that would have put around 626 homes on nearly 100 acres of land in Northwest Midland that includes the Nueva Vista Golf Course. The decision brought an end, at least temporarily, to a battle between a landowner, the Midland-Odessa Golf Corporation, and neighboring residents that included numerous Midland City Council and planning and zoning meetings. The council had previously approved annexation and preliminary zoning of the land in July, but council members stated during the process there were issues with site plans turned into the city and flooding. Residents of the neighboring Grassland Estates and Grassland Estates West had consistently called for the golf course to remain or see development that wasn't as dense. Some residents created a nonprofit called For Midland to buy the land from the owner and create a golf course slash recreation slash wildlife preserve opportunity. Autumn Winkles, representing the nonprofit, told the council Tuesday that there are people and entities that have pledged to the cause. She said after the meeting that she would like to make an offer to the landowner by the end of the calendar year, or certainly within 6 months. We need to, as a community, come together, raise the money, and purchase the course from Midland-Odessa Golf Corporation, Winkle said. If we think that everything's fine and we just sit back, this is going to keep coming back every 6 months, every year. Multiple council members praised Winkles and those working for For Midland for not just objecting to a plan, but working on a solution. It is very refreshing, said Councilwoman Lori Blong, of the idea of opposition coming up with a potential solution. I'm very impressed by the initiative that they've taken, with the gracious tone that their communications have shared with the council and city staff. And I think that they are bringing forward a potential solution. But the details of that are to be worked out between them and the landowner, not the city council. Developers were limited in their presentation compared to previous meetings, but stated that drainage has previously been studied in that area and a plan accounted for it. They said density is a bigger picture issue, as it is how the community approaches it and how it affects property taxes. Lastly, they said, everything proposed with the development is being seen across the community and that the proposed development is a benefit to Midland. Developers also reminded council members there was still 80 acres of green space in the proposal. Both items related to the Nueva Vista land, the zoning request, and a site plan were voted down unanimously. This article is entitled, Developer Seeking Incentives from Council for Hotel Project. The Thomas will offer 93 rooms in the heart of downtown. By Stuart Doreen. A developer approached the Midland City Council on Tuesday about bringing a boutique hotel to the heart of the downtown area. Brian De Palma of De Palma Hotels, based in Dallas, approached the Midland City Council on Tuesday looking for incentives to help with a $25 million project that will bring a 93-room boutique hotel to the 100 block of South Lorain Street. De Palma said the equity is raised, it is a privately funded project, but that he wants the city to consider an incentive package that represents 16% of the total project budget. A hotel occupancy grant of $4 million would be paid out for approved expenditures, including 100% of ad valorem taxes paid and business personal property tax for 5 years, and then 75% over the following 5 years. a city sales tax rebate of 50% for 7 years. A 50% city sales tax rebate having to do with construction and associated fees. The waiving of other impact, permit, and review fees. Developers are not seeking a cash incentive. "We don't need the cash," De Palma said. The hotel would tentatively be called the Thomas, and would convert a building that the developer said was built in 1927, making it the oldest high-rise in West Texas. The plan would include rehabilitation of a current building and construction of new rooms to bring the room total to 93. The hotel would be a Hilton brand, like the current hotel downtown, the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel Midland Plaza. Developers also said it would be part of the Hilton's Tapestry brand, which allows developers to embrace the independent nature of a hotel. Developers told the council that they have been involved with 70 properties and have another 80 properties in the pipeline. The hotel would have a restaurant that serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner, some meeting spaces, and valet parking. An average daily rate of $150 was expected in the beginning, De Palma said. The hotel will not be a big-box convention hotel. De Palma stated that once developers receive approval for the project, construction could be completed within 24 months. "Hilton calls me once a month, saying, 'When do we start?'" De Palma said. This article is entitled, "Man, 37, Accused of Killing Girlfriend." Affidavit states Serva told the victim her death would set example. By Caitlin Randall. Safir Armenta, whose body was found after being set on fire in Midland County, was allegedly murdered by her boyfriend, Sergio Antonio Serna, according to an arrest affidavit. The Midland County Sheriff's Office issued a capital murder warrant for Serna on Tuesday after he was arrested for unrelated charges in Reeves County, a county spokesman said in a statement. A probable cause affidavit for Serna, 37, states he sent threatening messages to Armenta, 25, before she died. Those messages allegedly included one that said, "Your car is going to be burned down, then you will be next." Serna also allegedly messaged Armenta that he wanted to see her plead for your fingers and your life. MCSO investigators interviewed Serna while he was in custody at Reeves County Jail. His affidavit states that he told investigators he last spoke to Armenta on October 28th when she stole 8 ounces of crystal meth from him. In the text messages cited in his affidavit, Serna accused Armenta of contacting the police and called her a snitch. He allegedly texted Armenta that her death would be an example for the rest. The affidavit states that Serna killed Armenta in retaliation for her taking his methamphetamine and called the police on him. A polygraph examination was conducted in Reeves County, which Serna failed, according to the affidavit. Family members told investigators that they last saw Armenta on October 27th when she went to visit them in El Paso and that she was in a relationship with Serna. Sheriff's deputies responded on November 2nd at about 5:45 p.m. to the 5500 block of Farm to Market Road 1213 in reference to a fire. Upon arrival, deputies discovered that a body was set on fire and badly burned. The body was identified as Armenta on November 8th. This article is entitled, "USGS Records 3.6 Magnitude Quake Northwest of Midland," by Mercedes Cordero. The U.S. Geological Survey reported an earthquake northwest of Midland early Tuesday morning. The USGS reports a 3.6 magnitude quake was recorded at 2:36 a.m. The quake took place 9 miles north-northwest of Midland at a depth of 4.84 miles, according to the USGS. The earthquake is the strongest to hit around Midland since October 23rd, when 3.4 and 3.6 magnitude quakes were reported north-northeast of Odessa. The EarthquakeTrack.com reported Tuesday there have been 19 quakes in the past 30 days and 219 in the past 365 days near Midland. This is the community from the front page. This article is entitled "Development's Opposition Sees Opportunity to Better Midland" by Stuart Doreen. It didn't take long Tuesday to see that the Nueva Vista development vote was not going to make it through the Midland City Council. And one reason was there was opposition willing to work toward a solution. Because for some people, it wasn't just about opposing requests for zone changes and site plans. It was about showing the council there was something better. For Midland is a nonprofit that started during the Nueva Vista saga. The nonprofit, according to its website, is a citizens' nonprofit conservancy effort to preserve and improve the land of Nueva Vista for today and generations to come. What does that mean? At this point, For Midland wants to see what the possibilities are, including keeping golf as a purpose of the acreage in Northwest Midland. But there are also opportunities for wildlife enthusiasts, hikers, runners, frisbee golfers, people who fish, and others. That is what Autumn Winkles of For Midland told the council on Tuesday morning during a briefing session. This is probably the most high-profile circumstance where we've had a resident come forward with a solution to a problem, Councilwoman Lori Blong told the reporter Telegram. And it makes it a whole lot easier as council to move forward to actual solutions. Often, we just have two adversarial parties, including one that is opposed to whatever is being proposed. And it's really difficult to come together in that circumstance. That's not what we've seen with For Midland in the way that they've managed this effort. Winkles said Tuesday that as much as Tuesday was a win for the neighboring areas, Grassland Estates and Grassland Estates West, there also is a responsibility to follow through with the For Midland initiative. That includes finding out what it will take for John Crane of the Midland Odessa Golf Corporation, the property owner, to sell. While this was a big win that the zoning didn't go through, the problem is not going to go away, Winkles said. Mr. Crane wants to sell, that's his right, and I want him to be able to retire. So we need to, as a community, to come together, raise the money, and purchase the course from him. If we don't do this, if we think that everything's fine and we just sit back, that this is going to keep coming back every 6 months, every year. And so we are working with some different foundations and different land trusts to figure out a way to get this done in the spirit of cooperation and ingenuity. Winkles added that she is now going to need people to put their money where their signature is, a reference to the 1,600 plus people who signed a petition to save Nueva Vista. In a perfect world, Winkle said, the nonprofit hooks into the willingness to partner for quality of life issues. Partnerships have made Centennial Park a game changer downtown, and another is underway to raise tens of millions to transform Hogan Park into a showcase for tournaments, soccer, softball, and baseball. Winkle thinks something similar is possible for the people of Midland, a park to keep people in Midland. Those interested can go to www.foremidland.com or to the nonprofit's YouTube channel, which includes a Save Nueva Vista video. This is the Nation page. This article is entitled GOP Majority Court to Mull Biden Mandate by Jeff Mulvihill, Associated Press. Challenges to President Joe Biden's COVID-19 vaccine mandate for private employers will be consolidated in the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, a panel dominated by judges appointed by Republicans. The Cincinnati-based court was selected Tuesday in a random drawing using ping-pong balls, a process employed when challenges to certain federal agency actions are filed in multiple courts. The selection could be good news for those challenging the administration's vaccine requirement, which includes officials in 27 Republican-led states, employers, and several conservative and business organizations. They argue the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Administration does not have the authority to impose the mandate. The challenges, along with some from unions that said the vaccine mandate didn't go far enough, were made this month in 12 circuit courts. Under an arcane system, it was up to the clerk of the judicial panel on multi-district litigation to select a ping-pong ball from a bin to choose where the cases would be heard. It was a favorable outcome for Republicans. 11 of the 16 full-time judges in the Sixth Circuit were appointed by Republican presidents. Accounting for one of the Republican-appointed judges, Helene White, who often sides with judges appointed by Democrats, and adding senior judges who are semi-retired but still hear cases, the split is 19-9 in favor of Republicans. Six of the full-time judges were appointed by former President Donald Trump. Another court where a majority of judges were nominated by Republicans, the New Orleans-based Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, issued a ruling that put the mandate on hold. It's not clear whether the court that will hear the case will act as the Fifth Circuit did and side quickly with the Republican challengers. But legal experts have become increasingly concerned in recent years about the politicization of both federal and state courts, raising questions about whether justice is fairly administered or dispensed through a partisan lens. Allison Orr Larson, a professor at William & Mary Law School, co-authored a study published this year that found growing partisanship in federal judicial decisions. For decades, the study found that rulings on cases in which all judges in a circuit weighed in generally were not decided along party lines based on the presidents who appointed the judges. We did see a concerning spike starting in 2018 that led us to wring our hands, Larson said in an interview. The increasing partisanship in a branch of government that is supposed to be blind to partisan politics was seen in judges appointed by presidents of both parties. But Larson said, it's not clear why that was or whether it will last. This article is entitled Analysis. GOP's Economic Wins Pose Hurdle for O'Rourke's Bid by Michael Smith and Emma Kinnery, Bloomberg. Beto O'Rourke took aim at Governor Greg Abbott's conservative stances on abortion, guns, and education Monday in announcing a bid to unseat him, saying the state needs a leader focused on bread-and-butter issues. But the Democrat faces an uphill battle in the conservative state, where Abbott can point to a track record of overseeing some of the fastest economic growth in the country. Texas's deep red Republican voting base is on board with the issues he's prioritized, and the many businesses flocking to the state aren't being dissuaded by the governor's conservative tilt. While O'Rourke has tried to position himself as a champion for everyday Texans, concerned the governor hasn't done enough to make sure there won't be a repeat of the deadly February blackout that left residents shivering in their homes, he has little support outside of the biggest cities. Abbott, meanwhile, has shored up support with his base by staking out increasingly conservative positions in recent months, seeking to diminish the threat of a primary challenge from the far right. And he can point to a string of recent successes, notably Tesla Inc.'s decision to move its headquarters to the state, as evidence that his stances aren't hurting Texas. Then there's the risk that the next election season could be tough for Democrats, particularly in a GOP stronghold like Texas, amid low approval ratings for President Joe Biden that hung over recent gubernatorial elections in Virginia and New Jersey. No Democrat has won statewide office in Texas since 1992. This is the Business and Oil page. This article is entitled Report: Export Ban Would Raise Gas Prices by Paul Takahashi, Houston Chronicle. Joe Biden faces mounting pressure from his Democratic Party to reverse the Obama administration's 2015 decision lifting the 40-year ban on U.S. crude exports to reduce gasoline prices that are at 7-year highs. However, reinstating a U.S. crude export ban would actually increase gasoline prices rather than reduce them, according to an analysis published Tuesday by energy research firm IHS Markit. A U.S. crude oil export ban would make the situation worse for the United States and the world. At a time when global supply chains are already under exceptional strain, said Jim Burkhard, IHS Markit's vice president and head of crude oil markets. Such a ban would disrupt global oil supply chains, run counter to decades of U.S. policy promoting the free flow of oil and gas, lead to inefficient and costly reallocation of domestic crude production, disrupt supplies for allies, and discourage domestic production, which would all put upward pressure on U.S. gasoline prices. It would also send an unnerving signal to allies and partners about the reliability of the United States. IHS Markit's report comes as some Democrats are calling on the Biden administration to end oil and natural gas exports over public concerns about rising gasoline prices, which are at their highest since 2014. The Biden administration earlier asked OPEC to increase foreign oil production to ease crude and gasoline prices. 11 Democratic senators, including Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts and Green New Deal author Ed Markey, urged Biden in a letter last week to act swiftly to address gasoline prices. The senators said high gasoline prices pose an undue burden on families and small businesses, and urged Biden to release oil from the nation's strategic reserve and consider banning U.S. crude exports. As the United States works to boost the development of clean and renewable energy over the long term, we must ensure that Americans are able to afford to fill up their cars at the pump in the meantime, the 11 senators wrote in the letter. Environmental groups are also pressuring the Biden administration to reimpose a crude export ban, but for a different reason. On Monday, 45 local and national environmental groups sent a letter to the Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Michael Regan, who is touring the Gulf Coast this week. The environmental groups urged the EPA and the Biden administration to reinstate the export ban to prevent pollution and climate-related natural disasters such as hurricanes that have ravaged the Gulf Coast in recent years. IHS Markit said U.S. gasoline prices are connected to the global oil and gasoline markets, not the price of U.S.-produced crude oil. A ban on exporting U.S. crude may lower the price of domestic crude, but this could discourage production of both oil and natural gas, which would likely result in a tighter global oil market and wouldn't lower gasoline prices. Eliminating 3 million barrels per day of U.S. crude exports would disrupt the domestic and global oil supply chain and would likely increase gasoline prices, IHS Markit found. The lost barrels would have to be replaced from somewhere else, and it is not clear if all of that could or would be replaced in a tight market, Burkhart said. Such a disruption of international crude oil flows would lead to a scramble to find other oil and generate more upward pressure on crude oil prices, and thus increase the price of U.S. gasoline. A ban on U.S. crude exports won't help U.S. refiners, IH Markit said. The U.S. produces light sweet crude, which is desired by foreign refineries. U.S. refineries, on the other hand, are designed to import and refine heavy sour crude from Canada, Mexico, and the Middle East. Oil produced in Texas, the top oil-producing state, would also be costly to move to refining centers on the Atlantic and Pacific coasts, IHS Markit said. There are no crude oil pipelines to either coast, and railroad facilities to transport crude by rail have been out of use. The most effective way to lower crude and gasoline prices is to increase crude production, IHS Markit found. The U.S. is the world's largest oil producer, and a crude export ban could put its status in jeopardy, IH Markit said. This article is entitled, EIA Says Tapping Oil Reserve Would Have Little Impact, by Gerson Freitas Jr. and Ari Natter, Bloomberg. Releasing oil from the U.S. government's strategic reserve would have a short-lived impact on soaring fuel prices, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. Our analysis shows that it's generally short-lived, a couple of months, and that typically the other dynamics in the market would overtake any decrease in price, Stephen Nally, EIA acting administrator, said Tuesday during testimony before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. A release of 15 million to 48 million barrels over a short period would bring crude prices down by about $2 a barrel, or the equivalent to as much as 10 cents per gallon of gasoline, Nally added. Restricting exports of domestic crude also do little because U.S. refiners rely on tremendous volumes of imported heavy crude that many of them are configured to process. As for natural gas, Nally said prices have been primarily driven by domestic factors, even as exports continue to grow as a share of total demand. While halting exports would immediately lower prices, it would also discourage production, he said. This article is entitled, IEA Says End of Oil Price Rally in Sight as Production Recovers, by Grant Smith, Bloomberg. The tightness in global oil markets that propelled prices to a seven-year high is starting to ease as production recovers in the U.S. and elsewhere, the International Energy Agency said. Demand growth remains robust, but supply is catching up, and changes in oil stockpiles seen in October suggest the tide might be turning, according to the IEA's monthly report. If the forecast proves to be correct, it would provide a significant relief for harried consumers who are suffering the consequences of price inflation. The world oil market remains tight by all measures, but a reprieve from the price rally could be on the horizon, the Paris-based IEA said in its monthly report. Production in the U.S. is ramping up in tandem with stronger oil prices. Global oil output increased by 1.4 million barrels a day last month and will add as much again over November and December as the Gulf of Mexico restores supplies halted by Hurricane Ida. American shale drillers are also taking advantage of higher prices to bolster drilling. Those extra barrels are coming on stream as the OPEC Plus alliance continues to revive exports it halted during the pandemic, the agency said. Crude futures surged above $86 a barrel in London last month on the combination of recovering post-pandemic consumption and a shortfall of natural gas supplies that spurred extra demand for oil. Prices have since retreated to under $83 as the U.S. contemplates action to bring down fuel costs. President Joe Biden has been considering a release from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve after the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its partners rebuffed his calls to restore production more quickly. The alliance, led by Saudi Arabia and Russia, has argued that it should stick to its gradual approach because demand remains fragile. OPEC Secretary General Mohamed Barkindo reiterated the group's standpoint on Tuesday, saying that global oil markets are poised to return to surplus from next month. Even without the deployment of the SPR, America is leading the supply rebound. This article is entitled, Rosneft Sees Oil Edging to $120 as Hike Lags Demand, by Dina Krenikova and Olga Tanas, Bloomberg. Global oil prices may rise to as high as $120 by the middle of next year, as the ability of OPEC Plus to meet demand is at risk from underinvestments and sanctions, according to a Rosneft executive. Today, OPEC Plus countries can't increase production to the extent necessary to meet demand, Otabek Karimov, the Russian company's vice president for commerce and logistics, said at a conference. As a result, there is a very serious deficit of energy resources in the whole world today. Naturally, this cannot but affect the price. Crude has soared almost 60% to above $82 a barrel this year as the recovery from the pandemic boosts demand, while the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and its allies are only gradually boosting supply. Russia's President Vladimir Putin said last month that $100 oil is quite possible, a view shared by Eni and Trafigura Group. Bank of America thinks it could go even higher to $120 by June. Karimov's comments come a day after senior officials from Russia, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, all members of OPEC Plus, said they expect the global market to become oversupplied soon, which could push prices lower and justifies the group's cautious approach. The International Energy Agency expects the price rally is coming to an end. While OPEC Plus is digging in its heels on monthly hikes of 400,000 barrels a day, actual increases are falling short, with members such as Nigeria and Angola struggling to raise supply amid a lack of investments. Russia, though, produced above its quota last month, according to the IEA. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, November 17th. Cynthia Loreen Schrenkel. Cynthia Loreen Cindy Schrenkel, age 62, went home to her Lord surrounded by family on November 11th. She was born August 24th, 1959, in Alice, Texas, to Bertha and George Garza. She is survived by her loving husband of 40 years, Peter Schrenkel, and her children Ashley Lamb, Clay, and Katie Walker, Miles. She is also survived by her four grandchildren, her father, George Garza, Sr., and her brother, George Garza, Jr., along with nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her mother, Bertha Garza. There will be a memorial service to celebrate Cindy on Thursday, November 18th at 10 a.m. at First Baptist Church in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Guadalupe Lupe Garcia. Guadalupe Lupe Garcia, 93, of Midland, passed away on November 12th. Lupe was born in San Angelo on October 5th, 1928, to the late Herminia Nava and Francisco Perez. Lupe is survived by her son, Ruben P. Garcia, Roberto Bobby Garcia, and wife Kelly, son-in-law Raymond G. Martinez, five grandchildren, 16 great-grandchildren, and four great-great-grandchildren. Lupe is preceded in death by her husband, Ruben Montes Garcia, daughters Gloria Castellón, Gracie Martinez, and her son Raul Roy Garcia. In lieu of flowers, the family wishes you to consider making a memorial donation in Lupe's honor to Hospice of Midland. Visitation will take place at Ellis Funeral Home on November 17th at 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Rosary will take place at 7 p.m. Services for Lupe will be held Thursday, November 18th at Our Lady of Guadalupe at 10 a.m. Lydia Lily Rodriguez. Lily Rodriguez, age 87, left us on November 11th to go home to join all her loved ones with God in heaven. Lily was born to Casimiro and Domitila Gonzalez on August 3rd, 1934. Lily is preceded in death by her parents, by two loving husbands, Leo Martinez and Isidro Rodriguez, and one daughter, Olga Enriquez. Lily leaves behind her sons, James Martinez, wife Diana, and Severo Enriquez, three granddaughters, as well as many loving nieces and nephews. Funeral services are being handled by Ellis Funeral Home. Visitation will be Tuesday, November 16th from 4 to 9 p.m., with rosary at 7 p.m. Funeral Mass will be Wednesday, November 17th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Church at 10 a.m. with burial to follow at 1 p.m. at Monahan's Memorial Cemetery, 400 South Helen Street. Marcos Pondo. Marcos Pondo, 20, of Midland, passed away on November 13th in Fort Worth. Marcos was born in Fort Worth to Gustavo and Manuela Pondo on October 9, 2001. He attended and graduated Midland High School in 2020. Marcos is preceded in death by his grandparents, Roberto Pondo, Maria Pondo, Saul Garcia, and Carlotto Garcia. Marcos is survived by his father, Gustavo, mother, Manuela, sister, Valerie, brother-in-law, Emmanuel, brother Gustavo Jr., sister-in-law Destiny, as well as many nieces, nephews, aunts, uncles, and cousins. Viewing will be Wednesday, November 17th from 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. and Thursday, November 18th from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. at Willowbrook Funeral Home Chapel. Rosary will be held at 7 p.m. Thursday, November 18th at Willowbrook Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral Mass will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, November 19th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church, with burial following at Serenity Memorial Gardens in Midland. Funeral services are entrusted to Willowbrook Funeral Home. To place online condolences, please visit www.willowbrk.com. Truett Skipper. April 4th, 1947 to October 26th, 2021. It is with deep sorrow that the family of Truett L. Skipper announces his passing on Tuesday, October 26th, at the age of 74. He will be lovingly remembered by his wife of 52 years, Sheila, children Chad, Marie, and Sean Allison, four grandchildren, as well as numerous nephews, nieces, relatives, and friends. He was preceded in death by his brothers, Billy, Frank, and Gary, and his parents, Dempsey and Linney. A celebration of Truett's life will be held on Friday, December 3rd, 12 p.m. at Peter Loring North, 2102 North Loop 1604 East, San Antonio, followed by a military service at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio. Memorial donations can be made to Remember the Alamo Foundation at thealamo.org. You are invited to sign the guest book at www.porterloring.com. Death notices. Jim Abney. Jim Abney, 53, of Midland, passed away November 12th. The family will have a service at 2 p.m. Saturday, November 20th at Deepwater Chosen Ministries inside Midland Chin Baptist Church. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Lois Bell. Lois Bell, 91, of Midland, passed away November 9th. The family will receive guests from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, November 20th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home. Funeral service will follow the visitation at 2 p.m. Saturday, November 20th at Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home Chapel, with interment following at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Online condolences can be made at www.npwelch.com.
This is Connie reading the Odessa American for November 17th, 2021. MCH Board votes in vaccine mandate. Hospital faced mandate or loss of almost $20 million a year. By Laura Dennis. The Ector County Hospital Board voted 4-3 to comply with the federal mandate that requires all hospital employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19, with only two pathways for an exemption. Medical Center Hospital CEO Russell Tippin said Tuesday that Ector County's public hospital, like all hospitals in the United States, faces both a federal mandate from the Biden administration as well as a Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, mandate to require healthcare worker vaccinations to receive federal funding. While a pending lawsuit on the federal mandate has a stay, there is not a current stay on the CMS mandate. The CMS funds MCH between 170 to 200 million dollars a year. A U.S. appeals court on Friday upheld its decision to put on hold an order by Biden for companies with 100 workers or more to require COVID-19 vaccines, rejecting a challenge by his administration. The now combined lawsuits have been sent to the Sixth Circuit. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton is also suing the administration. Tippin said the board voted to enact a mandate policy that mirrors the CDC's recommendation, adding that if the Paxton lawsuit is successful, that MCH will adjust our timeline with it as well. The roughly 2,200 employees at MCH have until December 5th to get their first vaccine and until January 4th for the second. Those getting a Johnson & Johnson, a single vaccine, have until December 5th. A more important deadline, Tippin said, is looming for employees who do not want the vaccine. Next Tuesday is the last day for employees to file for an exemption. Exemptions can be acquired two ways. The first is a medical disability waiver that must be completed by a qualified healthcare provider, and the second is to turn in paperwork for a sincerely held religious belief exemption. Both waivers will go to a hospital committee for approval or rejection. Tippin said MCH staff that are considered fully vaccinated now stands at about 65%. He said the board had no choice but to establish the policy as the hospital would be bankrupt without the CMS funding. He said the mandates from the government are devastating to hospitals everywhere that have been working nonstop since COVID started about 2 years ago. What are we going to do? Never has there been such a huge health care problem, and the government comes in and makes it more difficult to put qualified doctors, nurses, and housekeepers in place. Why would they, the Biden administration, enact this now when we are struggling to have staff to take care of people? He said the board meeting featured several employees who pleaded with the board to not force vaccines. He said it was an emotional, charged meeting. Our hope is that the staff will get vaccinated or get a waiver done in time, Tippin said. We cannot wait on this for the lawsuits to be settled. We are in a no-win situation. Of those unvaccinated at MCH, Tippin said nurses are the largest number of unvaccinated because nurses make up the majority of the staff. He said a loss of any number of employees during this time of short staffing could mean the start of changing the capabilities of what MCH can do. We may have to drop from 100 surgeries a day to maybe 40 or 60, or change clinic times from closing at 10 to closing at 8. The other option is we will shut our doors if we don't get the federal money. The 4-3 vote included Brian Dobb, Wallace Dunn, and Kathy Rhodes voting against the mandate. Tippin on Tuesday also addressed the final CMS report on a complaint made about patient care. The complaint, which did not come from the mother of a teen patient shown in a photo that went viral on social media, was about the COVID patient having a large plastic bag over her body and head as she sat in a wheelchair on oxygen at MCH. CMS sent an investigator to MCH last month to discuss MCH policy on how COVID patients are transported through the hospital. Tippin said MCH had already changed their transport policy prior to the CMS visit after the complaint. Tippin said the investigator was walked through the process, which had been changed to what he described as a halo drape that used PVC pipe over a bed or wheelchair to protect the patient and staff and other hospital patients during transport. Initially, the investigator said she liked it, but sent it up to her supervisor, who said that there was no need to drape a patient during transport anymore and that the MCH would need to be written a deficiency for the policy. It was okay before, but not now, and so we asked for clarification because of the anymore. And we were told the new CMS recommendation is to transport with a mask on and a sheet that covers the patient up to the neck. The new policy requires that hallways are cleared before COVID transports and that elevators are limited to one patient. Tippin said MCH immediately implemented that change. During that same site visit, the CMS investigator also noted that some signage on the walls had been taken down to paint the wall and not yet replaced, and also that one COVID page in the discharge packets for patients needed to be updated. Tippin said the CMS visit was over in about 24 hours and ended with all issues resolved by the time the investigator left. He added that CMS had 10 days to provide the report and that MCH had 10 days to respond, which was done by noon on Monday. Now CMS has 90 days to return and inspect the changes. There were no fines or license suspensions, but MCH is on what we call a provisional status until the final inspection. He said the final outcome is essential that CMS put them on a 90-day monitoring for deficiencies, but added that those deficiencies were corrected before the inspector left. He said discussions with other healthcare providers showed that many places were doing something similar to what MCH was doing, while others came up with other ways to keep patients safe during transport. He said the complaint also gave MCH officials the opportunity to self-evaluate. Although he also added that during 2 years of COVID, that other patients had sometimes refused the plastic drape, but that no one had complained. Wartime and pandemic medicine are not pretty. They, the plastic drapes, were effective, but we never intended to put anyone in harm's way. We thought not only were we protecting the patient, but their family and our staff, and to make sure everyone was safe. We thought we were doing the right thing. we should have done a better job. He said MCH officials learned they were not doing a good enough job communicating that to the mother of the patient. She was monitored the entire time and on oxygen. We have that documented, but our job is to do better, and we have learned a lesson to be more sensitive to the patient and their family. We have learned a big lesson. No matter how good we think our policy is, we need to pay attention. He also discussed the continuing threats that hospital staff members have received since the photo went viral on social media. Our staff took a massive amount of horrible threats, calling to tell us that they are going to come and shoot us in the parking lot or blow up the hospital. Tippin said those things are difficult to deal with for our staff that has spent almost 2 years dealing with COVID, but that they hope to move forward and continue providing quality health care in Odessa. OC announces HEX Endowed Scholarship by OA News at oaoa.com. Through the HEX Family Foundation, Odessa College has a new endowed scholarship that will help students studying technical fields with their tuition, books, and fees. The presentation of a $1 million check to the Odessa College Foundation to establish the Bill and Jane HEX Endowed Scholarship was made Tuesday in the foyer of the Salisbury Campus Center at OC. The HEX Family Foundation has made annual contributions throughout the OC Foundation's history to support students enrolled in technical programs. The new endowed scholarship will allow Odessa College to award a minimum of $30,000 per academic year to full-time, 12 years or more, and part-time, 6 to 11 hours, students enrolled in technical programs. OC President Gregory Williams said technical fields are programs where you can earn an associate degree and go into the world of work. Examples are nursing, welding, electrical programs, and computer technology. Billy HEX was a former mayor of Odessa who died in 2001. Since 1999, when the HEX Family Foundation was founded, they have contributed $25,000 each year to Odessa College to fund scholarships for students. Vice President of Advancement, Business and Governmental Relationships, Jackie Gore said, "When you do the math over those 22 years, they have provided $550,000 in scholarships to Odessa College students." Gore said the HEX Family Foundation has sent many students to school at OC over those years. "We have so many students coming in who are asking for those things, and this will help them," Gore said. "Now that's a legacy that will help students here at Odessa College for generations to come." HEX expressed thanks to everyone for attending. "We thank the Lord for OC, for Dr. Williams and Jackie, all the staff and all the students. We're blessed and happy to be able to be a small part in helping students with their tuition fees," HEX said. Williams said this was a celebration of kindness, love, beauty, and commitment to others. Williams said part of what the event Tuesday was about is not worrying about who gets the credit. Williams expressed his appreciation and gratitude for the gift and said he knows the foundation supports not just OC, but a number of other entities. Gore said, "When someone contributes and creates an endowed scholarship, They never touch the dollars that they contribute. We use up to 5% of the earnings to distribute to our students in Odessa College. The Foundation Board helps us to oversee that. So this will truly live on forever here at Odessa College. Over the last 3 years, the endowed scholarships here at Odessa College have grown from $10 million to now, with this $1 million, that brings us to $22 million in endowed scholarship, Gore said. That continues to grow, and that continues to help Odessa College students. That's been a real focus of the Odessa College Foundation over the last 3 years, and we want to continue to grow that. Hex said it makes her feel very blessed to be able to give back in this way and help students who might not normally be able to attend college. Hayes draws primary opponent. Odessan Dusty Fawcett has filed for the county judge seat by Laura Dennis. On Tuesday, Republican Dustin Fawcett filed to run for Ector County judge in the May 1st Republican primary. "We are at a critical time here in Ector County," Fawcett stated in the press release. Whether it was the pandemic, the February freeze, or even the constrained relationship within our institutions, Ector County and its citizens are starving for strong leadership. My campaign will not be about divisive partisan politics, but about unifying public policy. We will seek to solve problems in pursuit of progression and vision, rather than regression and division. During a recent interview, Fawcett said Ector County needs a county judge who can get along well with others, and that current Ector County Judge Debbie Hayes has shown during her first term as judge that she cannot do that. He cited her leadership during the COVID-19 crisis and also recent disagreements about how to parcel out American Rescue Funds as examples of a lack of leadership. Fawcett said the main issue in Ector County currently is cooperation among the various public entities. "We have amazing institutions," he said, citing Odessa College, UTPB, and Texas Tech University Health Science Center, as well as Medical Center Hospital and Odessa Regional Medical Center. "But we struggled during COVID, and there is no excuse for that. There is no excuse for not having relationships with others." Fawcett said Hayes is more interested in making friends and being in the spotlight rather than making public policy, adding, "There is a lot of discontent with the way she has been running things." He has never run for public office before, but was previously employed by both Motran and the Better Business Bureau. He said he seeks the county judge's seat because the county judge is critical, and a lot of what I did at Motran was about roads. Roads and infrastructure are the key to economic development. If we want Costco and Top Golf, we have to think 30 to 40 years out. You have to have that in place. We can't just want them. And as county judge, you can make that infrastructure happen. He said he has a positive vision for Ector County that includes working well with citizens and other institutions. Fawcett said he is a seventh-generation Texan whose Odessa roots date back to his late grandfather, Coach Myron Snyder, who was recently honored with the naming of Nimitz Junior High School's football field. Fawcett has two daughters, Margaret, Maggie, Grace, and Mia Faith, with wife Jennifer, a news release detailed. He is employed by ProCare in Odessa as a clinic manager. Fawcett said he serves the local community on the following boards: Centers for Children and Families, Young Professionals of Odessa, Alzheimer's Association, Walk to End Alzheimer's, Jesus House Women and Children's Center, City of Odessa Traffic Advisory Committee, City of Odessa Capital Improvement Advisory Committee, and Con Ector Task Force Broadband Initiative. Fawcett has developed a plan to ensure Ector County can get back on track and flourishes for years to come, the press release stated. My plan is simple. We focus on three pillars that must become the foundation for our success here in Ector County: investing in our infrastructure, utilizing and leveraging relationships with our local institutes, and creating a culture countywide that fosters innovations by focusing on economic development and American entrepreneurship, Fawcett stated in a press release. I have no doubt that with these three foundational pillars and with the great people of our community, we will be headed in the right direction. Together, we can take on this task, and together, we will exceed all expectations. Ector Together. Fawcett is inviting the public to join him for his announcement at 2:30 p.m. Thursday at the Ector County Commissioners' Chambers.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.